Well, good morning. It has been at least probably a month or so since we last looked at Daniel 9. For the past month, we've been considering or spending the bulk of our time in the book of Acts, chapter 15, and going from Deuteronomy 10 into Deuteronomy 11. And then just last week, we had our 8th annual church conference with Pastor Dan here with us. And I believe he did an admirable job in bringing forth 4 sermons relating to our salvation and how it is to affect our individual lives, bringing forth 4 biblical doctrines. And for those who may be listening to this particular series on Daniel 9, if you haven't done so, if you go to our church website, and it's already been posted, the 8th annual conference, when Pastor Dan Pentamone from Kansas City, he preached 4 sermons dealing with regeneration, justification, sanctification, and glorification. And so I invite you, if you have the time, to go back and listen to those. But again, as it relates to Daniel 9, and you can turn there with me, turn to Daniel chapter 9. It's been at least a month, if not more than a month, that we left off looking at this chapter. And what I would like to do, and it may take the rest of November, probably for Sunday school and the morning hour, to consider all the material, very important material. And for me, it's going to be the first time that I have ever touched upon the covenants to any great degree. And so you pray for me, okay? If you're going to take notes, do so. Go back and then check that up. Please do not rely upon your memory, okay? Daniel chapter 9, let me first read verses 24 to 27 to set the stage. Daniel here is being given what we know to be the 70 weeks of prophecy, or the 490 years of biblical prophecy. From Daniel's point of view, this was going from his spot in history. All that he is about to be given is prophecy in respects to his time frame, things yet to be. I contend that in the 21st century, looking back to Daniel, that the 490 years has run its course and finds all of its fulfillment focused in the person and work of Jesus Christ himself, Messiah the Prince. Verse 24, 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince, and that's Christ. And notice, he is the center focal point of this prophecy. Shall be 7 weeks, 62 weeks. And when you do the calculation, what the angel here is telling him, once the decree from a Persian king granting the rebuilding of the city and its walls, up until Messiah, up until Christ's coming, would be 483 years of time. The street shall be built again in the wall, even in troublous times. And I believe when you read the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, you will find the fulfillment of that little phrase. The rebuilding of the second temple, the rebuilding of the city walls and the city itself, in the face of much opposition from outside the city, and even from opposition from within the city amongst the Jews. When you read Ezra and Nehemiah, you will find out that some of the Jews did not even want to put their hands to the work. Some of the Jews even conspired against Nehemiah to get rid of him. They were not in agreement with him. Now notice, after 62 weeks, after the 483rd year of this timepiece, shall Messiah, Christ, shall be cut off, but not from himself, and the people of the prince shall come and shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. Now, the latter part of verses 26, for those of you that are keenly aware with history, points to the destruction of the city and the temple under emperor-to-be Titus, or at that time, General Titus. His father became emperor, Emperor Vespasian. As he goes back after Nero kills himself, you have the reign of four emperors. Within 18 months, you're going to have four emperors come and go, most of which were assassinated. Vespasian basically gives a jump start to the Roman Empire, puts it on life support, and literally revives the Roman Empire that was gasping, believe it or not, following June 68 AD, when Nero kills himself. The empire goes into a tailspin. Its northern and eastern provinces begin to rebel and believe that this was the most opportune time to break away from Roman dominance. Vespasian comes on the scene and has to grab all of those loose strings back to Rome while he leaves his son Titus, the general of the army, to continue the mop-up action against the Jewish revolt that lasted from 66 to 70 AD. And he, now in verse 27, we're going to be focusing on verse 27 probably for the rest of this month. And he shall confirm the covenant. So there we have to study the covenants with many for 1 week. Well, that 1 week is the last 7 years, I believe, to the 490 years of prophecy, the in total amount of time that this prophecy begs. 70 times 7, 490 years. 483rd year, I believe, is when Jesus Christ makes his public appearance at the Jordan, baptized by his first cousin John, and this inaugurates Jesus' public ministry, whereby John the Baptist says, he must now increase while I decrease. The star of John the Baptist is about to set under the horizon, while the star, Jesus Christ, the star, the main star, rises to his ascendancy in his public ministry. He shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. In the midst of the week, so if you say this is the last 7 years, if you come to the middle of that seventh year, that would be at the 3.5 year mark. And I find it ironic that Jesus' public ministry was 3.5 years. In the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of abomination, he shall make it desolate. I found it amazing that in Hebrews chapter 8, the writer of Hebrews says, as he's comparing Old and the New Testament, he says that what? The Old Testament is about to what? Vanish away. Jesus told the Jews when he walked out of the temple, your house shall be left to you desolate, even unto the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. Okay. My contention, right out of the jump, is the he of verse 27, okay, the person that's referred to by that pronoun, he, is not a future one-world antichrist that everybody today is talking about, preaching about, and warning about. I contend, and hopefully I would prove that, that the he that is referred to in verse 27, the he that confirms the new covenant, the person who stops any more need for a third temple with a Levitical priesthood and animal bloody sacrifices, is none other than Jesus Christ himself, and not a future European one world dictator going around ordering people to receive microchips in their body so that a satellite can track their movements and their business transactions at Walmart. That's my contention. We now come to the end of our journey in Daniel 9. And since it's been about a month at least, let's look at some basic assumptions that I have brought to the table. So please listen carefully. First assumption. In this particular portion of Scripture, we have a period of 490 years of prophecy being given to Brother Daniel in verses 24 to 27. 70 sevens are determined. Look at that verse 24. 70 sevens are determined. Well, to make sense of this prophecy, the question must be begged, are we dealing with days? Are we dealing with weeks? Are we talking about months? Or are we talking about years? What is the timepiece here? Well, it was quite evident that if we're talking about seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, and months, the prophecy makes no sense. I believe the 77s, and you find that most conservative interpreters and commentators will agree, that we're talking about a period spanning 490 years of human time, human history. The second assumption. This prophecy touches directly the city of Jerusalem and the ethnic people of the 12 tribes of Israel. Look at verse 24. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city. All right? So we got to be within the guardrails of this prophecy. We cannot stray outside of the walls, both sides of the walls, the right wall and the left wall, as we fit this prophecy in between these guardrails to keep us from wandering where we ought not to wander. We're not going to add nor subtract from God's word. So the 490 years is going to have direct bearing upon the ethnic covenant people of God, the Old Testament folks, and those Jews in the days of Jesus, and the events of the four gospel narratives as they portray the public ministry and life and work of Christ. And secondly, it affects the city. Next supposition or assumption. I believe that Christ is the major personage at the center of this 490-year timepiece. Look at verses 26. Well, look at verse 25. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince shall be. So Messiah the Prince is the main focal point. Notice also in verses, verses 26. After 62 weeks shall Messiah the Prince be cut off, but not for himself. And everybody would automatically assume, within the guardrails of divine truth, we're talking about the passion of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. We're talking about his substitutionary, vicarious atonement that he achieves and performs and fulfills on the cross. Everything told about him in reference to his coming, whether it be the seed of the woman of Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, all the way to the one who would come quickly to his temple in the writings of Isaiah, and in the closing book of Malachi, the fact that there would be a forerunner to this Messiah, known as John the Baptist, who would literally pave the way, the entrance for Messiah, and it was John the Baptist's responsibility to prepare for the Lord a people called after his name. Okay, so in verses 25 and 26, and I also contend that the he of verse 27 is Messiah the Prince. He is the one that's going to confirm a new covenant, and he is the one, by virtue of completing all the types and shadows, everything relating to tabernacle and temple, everything relating to the bloody sacrifices, the feast days, everything in type, shadow, and figure found in the Old Testament would converge at Calvary by Christ himself. And so he is the main focal point of this prophecy. He is not going to share any glory with a supposed future one-world dictator called the Antichrist. the Antichrist is not the He of verse 27. It is none other than Messiah, the Prince himself. Now, I know that so far, these assumptions would cause many in the professing evangelical church to fly off their pulpits and to fly off their pews. The next assumption, look at verse 24. I contend that six specific salvational realities will be fully accomplished upon the completion of the 490 years. It says very clearly in verse 24, again, looking at the text, adding nothing, taking away nothing. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. 490 years are destined, predestined upon thy people and upon thy city. And notice, to do what? What's going to happen at the end of the 490 years? Well, we're going to finish up transgression. We're going to make an end of sin. We're going to make reconciliation for iniquity. We're going to bring in everlasting righteousness. And we're going to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the Most Holy. Now, if you're a premillennial dispensationalist, you will contend that everything mentioned in verses 24 is yet to be fulfilled. And they will be fulfilled, according to that scheme, in the 1,000-year reign of Christ upon the earth, sitting in a capital city in Jerusalem on a literal Davidic throne, beating the nations into subjection with a rod of iron. And the Jews, the ethnic covenant people, will finally cash in on the Abrahamic covenant, the Davidic covenant, and all the promises made to Abraham about his seed that would follow him would then become fully realized in this 1,000-year reign upon the earth, which, according to our premillennial dispensational friends, is yet to be in our future. But I contend that everything found in verses 24 in a previous message, if you go back to the website under Daniel 9, I believe that these six realities were all completed by Christ himself. He is the one that's going to wrap up all of these six salvational blessings. If you look at that, there's nothing there denoting government. There's nothing there of a geopolitical nature. Everything that is mentioned by way of the context in verse 24 relates to salvation. Sin is going to be dealt with. The penalty of sin is going to be met. Righteousness and peace are going to be brought forth. And I believe that Jesus Christ fully accomplished all that upon the cross when he said in great victorious words, "It is finished," or "It is accomplished," as some translations render it. Okay, what else do I bring to the table by way of review? Messiah would be cut off, but not for himself, after the 483rd year of this timepiece. Notice once again, verse 26. After 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off. So following the 483rd year of this 490-year prophecy piece, Messiah is going to be cut off. The next assumption, and here's where I now begin to divide on this fork in the road. I contend that there are no gaps of unspecified time between any portion of this 490 years, especially between the 483rd year and the last 7 years. If you look up here on my wipe-up board, I'll just simply put it this way. You have 490 years of prophecy. You have 483 of those years will bring us up to Messiah, the Prince who would come, and he would be cut off thereafter. And you have the last 7 years. I'm contending that between the 483rd year and the so-called last remaining seven, there is no gap. Where is the gap? Where is it even hinted? Where is it even implied in the reading of verses 24 to 27? That's my contention. Now, there was a time when I did believe that there was a gap because that's what I was taught and that's what I held to, thinking that there was no other interpretation to this portion of Daniel 9 other than a premillennial dispensational approach. I was taught that in verses 26 and verse 27, between those two verses, you must place the current age of grace, or the dispensation of grace, or the dispensation of the church, or the church age, beginning with Pentecost, Acts 2, terminating at the supposed secret rapture of the church, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, or Revelation chapter 4, verse 1. But where is a gap even hinted at? Where is a gap even implied? Where does the angel tell Daniel, oh, by the way, between this period and this next word, interject a gap in your thinking? It is not found. I contend that the word and in verses 27 is simply connecting all the words that come before it. It is connecting. It's bringing them together, not dividing them. Next assumption. Therefore, there is no future secret rapture of the church followed by a seven-year period of great tribulation. The very passage again hints at no gaps in the timepiece given, only if you force it into the context. I believe that if you're going to put a gap there, you're doing it at the expense and the violence of Scripture. Now look at my whiteboard board, and I'm just going to simply toss this out for you to think about. I believe that there's a connection between the 70 years of exile. Let me put the number 70 on the board. You've got 70 years of exile, right? And those 70 years, based on Daniel 9 in his reading of the book of Jeremiah, he's sensing that those 70 years of exile are about to end, right? That's the context of Daniel 9. As he reads the Bible, he reads Jeremiah's scroll, and he comes to the conclusion, since Daniel was still alive and he was there during the first exile of 605 or 606 BC by Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 1, right? He's able to do the math, and he knows that pretty soon these 70 years of exile are going to come to an end. When he's given this particular prophecy, I find it amazing that you have 77s given to this prophecy. So I see a relationship between the 70 years of exile and the 77s that make up this 490 years of prophecy. Now let me interject this into your minds. Was there a gap between the 69th year and the 70th year of exile? If we're going to say that there's a correlation or a relationship between 70 years of exile and the 77s, was there a gap of unspecified time between the 69th year and the 70th year of exile? Now, when you read the Bible and when you look at history, there was no gap. The 70 years of exile ran conclusively one year after the other. And if there is a correlation or a relationship between 70 years of exile and 77s, then it would stand to reason that there is no gap at all between the 483rd year and the last remaining seven. Again, read this portion several times. Read it over and over again. I would like someone to be given this for the first time, not knowing any of the so-called futuristic schemes of prophecy. Give someone a copy of Daniel 9 who's never been exposed to the Bible, never been exposed to all that they hear today. Let them read Daniel 9, 24 to 27 on their own, with no interjection at all, my side or the other opponent's side, and just ask them, what do you think? Do you see any gaps or any parenthesis of unspecified time? And I would love to hear someone give me an answer if they simply read this portion with no presuppositions and no assumptions going into it at all. Beloved, there is no gap between verses 26 and 27. The next assumption. This prophecy also predicted the Roman destruction of the old economy in AD 70. wiping away forever the temple, the Levitical priesthood, the need for bloody sacrifices, even the need for physical circumcision, all the types, shadows, and figures of the old economy were simply wiped away because there's no need for them at all. Turn with me to Luke's Gospel, chapter 21. Look at Luke's Gospel, chapter 21. Luke's Gospel, chapter 21. And notice these words. Luke chapter 21, look at verses 14 and following. Now, in Luke 21, we have Luke's parallel synoptic account of the Olivet Discourse. Now, Luke wasn't there to hear this. Neither was the Apostle Paul there, because we know that Paul and Luke were very close associates, were they not? Starting in the second missionary journey and in the rest of the book of Acts, Luke is a companion of the Apostle Paul. But I can say with much dogmatism, Luke the physician was not on the Mount of Olives when that discourse was given, and neither was Saul of Tarsus on the Mount of Olives given. So Luke had to get this material from those who were there and those who heard it. All right? Look at verses 14. Settle it therefore in your hearts, not to meditate before what ye shall answer. Now notice, let's ask those questions. Who's speaking? Jesus. To whom is he speaking? Well, to the 12. When and where was he speaking? He departs from the temple. And you got to go to Matthew chapter 23 to see that. After cleaning up the temple and causing a ruckus on the second time when he did this right in the house of God. And he walks out of that building telling those behind him, your house is left to you desolate. Remember that? And then they go east, cross the Kindred Valley to the Mount of Olives. And then the apostles are looking back at this beautiful building, gleaming white in that hot Judean sun. They marvel at the beauty of the building. They call attention to the building, to Jesus. And Jesus then begins to tell them, what you're looking at is going to come crashing down. One stone upon another is going to be toppled down. And beloved, to the Jewish ear, that was paramount to treason. How in the world could that happen? As magnificent, as beautiful, as solid, and as firm as that building looked, how in the world is it going to be brought to the ground? And then Jesus gives the Olivet Discourse. Now notice, he's talking here in the plural. He's not talking about a future generation of people. He's talking to those who heard him on that exact time and location in reference to the temple and the events that would follow. For I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay nor resist. Well, beloved, I think you find that being fulfilled in the book of Acts. When the early church came into conflict with the religious Jewish leaders in the opening chapters of Acts. And then later on, it's going to be fulfilled in the mouth of Peter and Paul when they stand before what? Delegates representing the power and the might of the Roman Empire, right? Remember when King Agrippa, when Paul was talking of what? Righteousness and judgment to come. He shook. His knees were shaken. And he told Paul what? I'm going to call you for a more convenient time. Get away from here. You almost convinced me to be a believer. And Agrippa just simply brushes Paul off to the side. And ye shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren, kinsfolk and friends, and some of you shall they cause to be put to death. Well, what do you find in the book of Acts? James is put to death. Stephen is put to death. Peter and Paul die under the reign of Nero in the opening phases of the Jewish revolt against Rome. And ye shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. Again, I appeal to you. Those who cry literalism, be literal, Pastor Bob. Well, I am. I am reading it literally, looking at who's talking and to whom is the audience. Jesus is not speaking to a yet-to-be-born generation of people, yet-to-be-born and yet to hear these words. He's talking to those of his own generation who could see him and hear him when he delineates what we know to be as the Olivet Discourse. Continue. And ye shall be hated of all men for my name's sake, but there shall not a hair of your head perish. In your patience, in your perseverance, in your endurance, possess ye your souls. And when ye shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Notice, when you see those Roman hordes, those uncircumcised Roman dogs and pigs circling the city, know that your desolation is nigh. And again, what did Jesus say when he left in Matthew 23? Your house is left to you desolate. What does Daniel 9 talk about? A desolation that was going to come. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let them which are in the midst of it depart out. Let not them that are in the countries enter therein. So versus being a supposed worldwide catastrophe, here Jesus apparently is delineating and describing a local catastrophe fixed in Judea, centered around the city of Jerusalem. And in verses 21, it says, when you see these signs, you, not a future generation yet to be born, you are to flee from the city, from Judea, into the mountains. And lo and behold, history tells us, by the former Jewish general turned Roman friend, Josephus, Flavius Josephus, that not one Christian died in the killing frenzy by the Romans. They all fled to the mountain city of Petra. So again, this has nothing to do with planes all around the world landing in Tel Aviv, where Gentiles and Jews fleeing to the Judean mountains yet to be. This is a local catastrophe. This is a local cataclysmic event, not a global event as many teach today. And these be the days of vengeance, and all things which are written may be fulfilled. So apparently the destruction of Jerusalem seems to be a terminating point, just like the cross of Jesus was a terminating point. The cross of Jesus Christ was the focal point of all the Old Testament prophecies about the seed of the woman who was to come. The one who was to be born of a virgin was to come. The one who was to be born in Bethlehem Ephratah was to come. The one that David describes in Psalm 22. The one that Isaiah describes in great detail in Isaiah chapter 53. Shiloh, the lawgiver, coming out of Judah. All of this terminated at the cross. Well, apparently this cataclysmic event that would fall upon the city and God's people is called a day of vengeance. Why is it called the day of vengeance, beloved? It's because the Son of God is now taking vengeance on those who put him to death. Read Revelation 1. Those who pierced him shall mourn. And that's not talking about the second coming of Christ. It's talking about the judgment coming of Christ himself in AD 70 on the people and the city that murdered him. And that may be kind of rough for some of you that are now listening to this, because you've been brainwashed, like I was brainwashed, with a prophetic scheme that may look and sound good, makes a lot of movies and prints a lot of books, but it doesn't match the scriptures. Read on. Woe unto them that are with child, and them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land, and wrath upon the people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Well, there are those who say, well, it was partially fulfilled in AD 70, but it's yet to be fulfilled in the future when we rebuild the Temple of Solomon for a third occasion. No, beloved. Jesus was talking to people. He was talking to those of his generation who would witness all of these things. Not a future generation, but that generation who would witness these events some 40 years later. Now, I want to terminate this first lesson by turning to Hebrews chapter 8 and doing a quick word study for those of you taking notes. Turn to the book of Hebrews chapter 8. Verses 10 and following, I believe in Daniel 9:27, the covenant that is being spoken of in Daniel 9:27 that's going to be brought into being is the new covenant prophesied by Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and that was instituted by Christ himself. What did Jesus say on the night of his betrayal? This is the blood or the cup of the New Testament, which is being shed for many. Jesus is the one who lifts the cup, blesses it, and states for all to know, this cup represents the bringing forth of that new covenant. And I believe the writer of Hebrews, the Apostle Paul, is referring to that covenant. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws in their mind, write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. Beloved, this has nothing geopolitical about it. This has nothing to do with guns, bullets, and tanks and planes. This has nothing to do with a third or a fourth rebuilt temple. This happens to be nothing more but Paul describing to us the new covenant as it relates to the salvation of God's elect. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor, and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for all shall know me, from the least to the greatest. For I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. Well, the writer of Hebrews is referring to the new covenant. Now, notice how this chapter ends. In that he saith a new covenant, he that made the first old. Now, that which is decayeth and waxeth old, present tense in the Greek, meaning that whoever wrote this before AD 70, and the last vestures of the Old Testament economy were simply fading away and will be ultimately erased off the globe by the Romans. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. Very quickly, with the time I have left, those of you taking notes, the Greek word translated decayeth means to make ancient. To make ancient. But notice this one. To be worn out due to time. To be basically worn out due to use and time. Well, beloved, when Jesus died on the cross and when he said it is finished, that's what he meant. It's finished. It's done. Paid in full. There was no need any. From that point on, there's no need, any further need for bloody sacrifices. And those who advocate the rebuilding of a third and probably a fourth temple, based on how you interpret, during the millennial reign, the last closing chapters of Ezekiel apparently describing this third or fourth temple that's going to be standing in the earthly millennial here on the earth, you're going to have sacrifices. And according to the last closing chapters of Ezekiel, those sacrifices are being done to make an atonement. Well, I thought the atonement was settled upon the cross. And therefore, to me, that teaching is no longer in error. It becomes a rank heresy and an insult to Christ and a slap across his cheek in reference to what he has finished on Calvary. It also means to be abrogated. Quickly turn to Hebrews 1:11 for those of you taking notes. Let me show you where the same word is used in the Greek text. Hebrews chapter 1, look at verse 11 quickly. Let me show you where the same word is used. The word decayeth. talking about the earth, the heavens, and the work of thy hands. They shall perish, but thou remainest. They all shall wax old as doth a garment. Waxing old is the same Greek word that is translated decayeth in Hebrews 8 and 13. Now go back to Hebrews 8 and verse 13. The next phrase, wax it old. See the two words? Wax it old. Those words mean to be frail from age. Literally, to grow old. And so when Jesus fulfills all of the requirements of the law, when Jesus fulfills every type and shadow in the tabernacle, in the temple, Jesus fulfills all the prophecies about him, his virgin birth, the very city or the village where he was born, Psalm 22, Isaiah 53, the lawgiver coming, okay, being risen, exalted to the right hand of the Father, presiding over his kingdom in the hearts of his people, the old economy becomes a senior citizen. And it had to die. Look at the term vanish away. You might like this one. To vanish away. It means literally to disappear, to destroy, or come to destruction. And that's exactly what happened in AD 70. The city and the last vestige, the very nerve center of Judaism, had to go. And Luke tells us from the very lips of Jesus, it was the day of Christ's vengeance upon those who murdered him, who hated him without a cause. Well, that's our first installment to Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. Let's close in prayer, and may God bless the remainder of our journey in this particular closing of Daniel 9:27.